Welcome to week three of the series of Relight. Excuse me. The formula for successful relationships. Today we're going to deal with two topics. Part one is just to clarify and to complete some of the concepts we were talking about last week and the first week. And then we're going to get, hopefully, to the second letter of Relight, which is the E, standing for empower, which is related to respect as well. So let's just initially just review a little bit from the first 2 weeks. Oh, sorry. It is, if I can find the... Oh. We'll talk about compromise in a minute. Okay. So far we've discussed that respect is the foundation of all relationships. One cannot have proper love if there's no respect. Respect must come first. We define respect as acknowledging the value and really appreciating the value of another individual that is outside of myself. Last week we talked about that every person has value. Every person has different needs. Every person has different perspectives, has different outlooks. We talked last week about the fact that every person contributes to a relationship and everyone brings something to a relationship, because that's the principle of giving and receiving, right? In every relationship, both must give, both must receive. Respect also is expressed in the concept that we discussed of acceptance. Acceptance, not trying to change someone, accepting the way they are. Accepting the value for what they are. And finding those qualities within the person that are so valuable. And even if respect is lost, to try and reignite it by making a mental reflection of what the value of the other person is, because every person does have value. I once dealt with a couple, just on that note, I once dealt with a couple that there was tension, because as they married and developed their careers and sort of started doing various things, it became apparent that they were very different, and that often happens. The man, the husband, was extremely outgoing, very, very community-minded, one, a go-getter, an ambitious person. Someone wanted to get out there and do things. His wife, much more reserved, less ambitious, happy with more family-centered activities. And the tension became because he felt that she was holding him back. That it needed to be a team. The things he wanted to do, he needed her help, he needed her involvement, and she was holding him back. And the tension, when tension happens, it tends to escalate. So what happens is, once there's a negative viewpoint, once there's a negative focus, you know, if you're thinking negative, you find plenty more. That's how it works. So as soon as there's conflict, as soon as there's tension, you find this is wrong and that is wrong. All of a sudden, all the transgressions in the last century show up. You know, that's what tends to happen, right? And it led to a loss of respect. Because when someone is very focused on doing something which they perceive to be very important, you have to understand, that's the whole concept of respect. When two people look at the world differently, and therefore he's looking at the world as the things that he wanted to do, and not self-centered. Things he wanted to do was to save the world. He wanted to do things that would be beneficial for other people. So it wasn't perceived by him, or by her necessarily, as a self-centered process. It was very altruistic, it was very important, it really was something that he wanted to do, it just wasn't her. And therefore what that leads to is, because if I want to do something that's so important, and I feel that someone else is holding me back, obviously what that's going to lead to is loss of respect. And in that particular story, the shift happened when he started to reflect and he started to exercise the things we were talking about last week. took a step back and said, hold on a second. Okay, first of all, there has to be this concept of acceptance. This is what it is. You can't change other people. If you discover things about them you didn't know about before, that's the way they are. People change themselves, but you cannot change other people. But more importantly, he began to reflect, or forced himself to reflect, exactly what we were talking about last week, on the value of his wife. What is it? What are the good? Forget about what she's not doing. Forget about what she's doing to hold me back. What is it that she is doing? And what he discovered was that if not for her, he'd be a total mess. That she had qualities which were probably in line with her personality that were grounding him, that were keeping him in focus, that were making sure that he doesn't become arrogant and overambitious to the point where he loses focus of what he wants to do and starts stepping on other people's toes and start abusing other people. That she was actually the key to his success. And he had to find a way to focus on that, which he did. And the things which he perceived before were holding him back, he had to find a way to work around that. But as soon as he identified the value that she was contributing to the relationship, the whole respect changed. The respect was reignited. He understood that on the contrary, he actually needs her contribution to the relationship. The qualities she has maybe are so important that in fact they're more important than the qualities he would want her to have. And as soon as he was able to identify the value that she had and the contribution that she was making to the relationship, the whole thing changed. He was able to reignite that respect. And everything went upwards from there. So that's the kind of thing we were talking about last week. Now, we need to clarify something because this obviously always comes up. When we talk about respect, and we talk about being sensitive to other people, meaning being sensitive to their world, their emotions, their needs, their feelings, obviously the obvious question that comes up is that they need to be respectful and sensitive to my needs as well. Right. So obviously respect is a two-way street. And very often, there's a lot of conflict because I want to try and respect the other person, I want to try and accommodate what they want, but really I want them to do the same. So it's all very good for them to want me to respect them, but is it a two-way street? And how does one create that two-way street? And what does that all mean? So, first of all, let me share with you a beautiful general idea. In the time of the temple, there was a practice that every day in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, there would be korbanot. A korban means a sacrifice. Right? Understand the meaning and the importance of sacrifice is something, animal sacrifices is something that's a different discussion. It's a hard topic in the context of today's world. But nevertheless, that was the concept. Concept of a sacrifice was they would bring sacrifices every day, and the sacrifice, when someone brought an animal and he brought a sacrifice, offered it up, the animal, to God, it was an expression of connection, it was an expression of relationship between us and God. I take something that belongs to me, I give it up, I give it to God, and that was the concept of a korban. Now the word korban, okay, the word in Hebrew, and I think I put it on the handout, the word korban actually has two translations. The one translation is sacrifice. The other is closeness. In Hebrew, the word korban comes from the word kiruv, which is close. Karov, to be close. And it's interesting that those two translations are the same word, because closeness, relationship, connection, requires sacrifice. Okay? It's a mindset that we have to always develop in relationships. If you want to take the opportunity of relationships, if you want to grow as individuals through relationships and through the difference that relationship brings, as we explained the first week, and through becoming a better human being by extending myself and accommodating someone else's world and understanding someone else's world, that's an amazing opportunity that God gave us, the opportunity of relationships, the opportunity to grow through relationships, but it requires a price. And that price is sacrifice. All right, so kiruv, korban, to come close, requires a sacrifice. And when in a relationship, mutual respect brings to a mindset of giving, to a mindset where it's okay to give something up. It's not okay to lose my individuality. It's not okay for you to abuse me and to compromise my dignity. It's not okay for you to compromise and undermine in any way my individual identity and personality. But it's okay for me to give something up. It's two different things. When there's a mindset of giving, then a lot of conflict falls away, because each one's mindset is, how can I accommodate you without compromising my own identity? I'll tell you a cute story from, there was a great Hasidic rabbi called Rav Levi Yitzchok of Berditchev. In the town, Rav Levi Yitzchok of Berditchev was very well known as the advocate of the Jewish people. He'd always find good things about people. He would always say good things about people. He was a tremendous leader. Anyway, he was the rabbi of the town of Berditchev. In the town of Berditchev lived an individual who was known as the town's miser. Right? No one liked him. He was like a very hidden guy. No one ever gave anything. He just wasn't a liked guy at all. Right? And he had very, very few friends. A very wealthy individual, but very, very few friends. One day this guy died. So it was understood, people could say it, but it was very well known that the Chevra Kadisha are going to struggle to get a minion for this funeral, because this guy didn't have any friends, so it's going to be a very, very small affair. Suddenly, Rav Levi Yitzchok of Berditchev let it be known that he, although it wasn't his normal practice, his intention is to attend this funeral. Everyone's really surprised. I mean, normally you'd only reserve that. It's a very rare occasion. The rabbi himself would only come out to, it wasn't like a regular rabbi officiates at a funeral. He was a tremendous tzaddik, a tremendous leader. He didn't normally do that kind of thing. It wasn't his normal function, but he let it be known that he would do that. And of course, once he came out, the whole town came out, so this guy had an incredibly honorable funeral. Someone couldn't contain the curiosity, and he went to Levi Yitzchok and he said, what was this all about? Like, everyone knows this guy is not the tzaddik of the town, right? It's a well-known fact. It's not Lashon Hara. It's just well-known, right? No one was particularly his friend. So why did you insist on giving him such respect and such? So Levi Soditchev says, because as the rabbi of the town, I know this guy on a different level. And I know him from three stories. Now, I was actually trying to look for the story this morning and I couldn't find it, so I forgot the second two stories. But the first one is what I really wanted to bring out. He said, I know him from a particular story because he came to me for a din Torah. Din Torah is like a court case in Beis Din. And I remember his conduct at the din Torah, and that was one of the reasons I came out to this funeral. What was the din? What was the story? The story was, there was a guy in Berditchev, a really shlemazel. You know, everyone knows what shlemazel is? A guy that just never succeeds at anything. I didn't know what to do, and he tried this and tried that, and he didn't have any money and any resources, and his wife was driving him nuts, and the family was hungry, and he really didn't know what to do. So he was such under distress from his whole family, and he was getting such pressure, he decided one day, he comes home and he says to his family, listen, there's tremendous business opportunities somewhere else in a different town. I think I need to travel there and try and make it. So his wife says to him, that's all very good, but it's going to take you a couple of years. In the meantime, like, how are we supposed to live? So without thinking and taking a huge risk, and he was leaving the next morning anyway, he says, not a problem. That guy, and in naming that particular miser, he said he's willing to loan us the money and just pick up every week a check from his office, and he'll keep you going for the next 2 years until I come back with the fortune that I'm going to make. His wife didn't know any better. Next morning, he disappears. Of course, it was a story that never happened. So the next Friday, his wife arrives at the office of this miser and says she wants to see and asks the secretary what's all about. So he says, yeah, my husband told me that I'm supposed to pick up a check every Friday. The secretary said, I don't know anything about it. I'll ask the guy. And she goes in and tells him the story and comes out with a check and says, yeah, here's your check. So she started doing this every single Friday. Every single Friday she'd arrive and receive the money. 2 years later, the guy comes back. He actually made it. He taka made it overseas. And he came back and he was a man of means. He had what to provide for his family for the next 2 years. But he comes in and he's like really scared because he doesn't know what kind of welcome he's going to get because he left his wife family with this Baba Meisa, with this crazy story that never happened. And he expects to find them really, really destitute and he thinks he's going to get it over the head. The only saving grace is that he at least has what to give them for the next 2 years. comes into the house and he sees everything is going really well. So he's all surprised. He says to his wife, what's this? How did you manage last year? He says, what do you mean, how did you manage? You told me to go every Friday to pick up a check, and that's exactly what I did. So this guy felt so embarrassed. He couldn't understand what happened. This is the miser, right? Who's supposed to not give any charity. So he goes and he makes an appointment to see this guy, and he says, listen, I made up this story, but the story I made up was that you're gonna loan the money. So I'm really thank you for having done it, even though I never actually spoke to you about it. But I've come to repay my loan. So the guy says, what do you mean repay your loan? You can't do that. I had the mitzvah of giving tzedakah for the last 2 years, and I'm not planning on giving it away. So you don't owe me the money. He says, what are you talking about? I need to give you the money because I didn't intend to take a handout from you. I merely said it would be a loan. That was my intention, although it was a fictitious intention, but that was the words I said. So I owe you the money. So they had a machlek, they had a dispute. He insisted on paying him back and he refused to take the money. So they said, well, what if two Jews would have a dispute? You've got to go to the rabbi. So they came to the rabbi for a din Torah. This was the din Torah. This was the dispute they had. He insisted on paying back the loan. The other guy insisted on not taking it. Says the Baddish Shavarov, this is one of the stories that happened with this guy. Now you want to know why I attended his funeral? Why am I telling you this story? Because it's a very rare thing. I mean, we think, oh, that's like a crazy... I mean, who would have a dispute about... Right? The disputes we know about work the other way around, right? But it's all got to do with the mindset. It's a mindset. These two people were very, very good people. They had a mindset of giving. And the mindset of giving was such that he wasn't prepared to give away his opportunity to give. The other guy wasn't prepared to give away his opportunity. I don't know what the ruling was, by the way. It'll be interesting. It doesn't say in the story what the rabbi decided. But what I'm trying to bring out is that sometimes when two people have a conflict, it really has to do not so much with the issues. It's got to do with the context in which they have the dispute. It's got to do with the mindset that they have at the time. And in relationships, if we can develop this concept of respect where we value each other, and the valuing of each other expresses itself in real respect, real accommodation of someone else's needs, really being sensitive to other people's needs, then a lot of disputes and a lot of conflict fall away because there's just a determination on both sides, if it's mutual, to work this out. Let's try and work this out because I am desperate to accommodate you, you are desperate to accommodate me because we have a deep respect for each other. Deep respect for each other means that we need to accommodate each other without compromising each other's individuality. Let's move this out. Let's find a creative solution. Let's find a creative compromise. Let's find a way out where we're both happy. All right. Very often that doesn't happen because people get stuck in looking at themselves. It's just a stuck issue. People get stuck so much in looking at what they need rather than looking at the respect for the other individual. If they both were focused, if the mindset shifted to a mindset of sacrifice, to a mindset of giving, and that's okay. It doesn't compromise our individuality to give and to give up. And relationships require closeness, requires sacrifice. But having said that, often there is a conflict. And how do you accomplish mutual respect where everyone else's needs are different? So, beyond the mindset of giving, let me share with you, I think we might have done this once, but let me just share with you a little formula, which I think is a great formula. First thing to understand in any relationship is that everyone has needs. But there's a tremendous difference between what we need and what we want. Okay? The definition of a need is something that I really believe I cannot do without. And that could be a physical thing. It could be an emotional thing. In children, in parenting, a child, every child is different. A particular child might need more attention, might need more love, might need more time. It might be an essential need for the development of that person. In a marriage, one person might be more needy for attention than the other. Some people like to be alone, more space. Other people like to be more close. But it might be a real need. It might be something that if they don't have that, it really compromises their development. Right? It might be a psychological thing. It might be a value thing, a conviction. that someone really believes in something very strongly and therefore needs something to happen, because if it doesn't happen, it compromises their essential value system. Every person has to have a value system. Every person has to have a code of morality. Someone might have such a conviction and a belief in their code of morality that it's a need. It becomes a need. It becomes something they must have. The definition of a want is something that I really want, but I don't need. I can do without. I'll function fine without it. Now, the truth is that ideally we want to go through life trying to maximize our wants and minimize our needs. What I mean is, some people are so focused on themselves that everything is a need. Like, they just fall apart if they don't get what they want, right? That doesn't mean it necessarily becomes a need. One has to be a... We're talking about in the context of a selfless person, the context of a person that's not egocentric. Nevertheless, we're all individuals. We have needs. In conflict, in respect issues, in relationships, when there's... It comes down to a real practical tension and conflict about, I want to do something, you want to do something else. The first question that both of us need to ask is this a need or a want? And the formula is a very simple formula. If there's respect, then a need will win over a want. Follow me? In other words, if what I want to do is my need, but what you want to do is just something you want, and we're both honest about it, then a person with respect will sacrifice their want for the other person's need. And that's what sacrifice is all about. Because sacrifice always means I give up something that I want. Because if I didn't give up something, if I didn't want it, then it's not a sacrifice. So sacrifice by definition means I have something that's mine, I have something that I want, something I could enjoy, something that would be really great if I had it. But the power of the human being is that I'm able to give that up because I respect your need. So very, very often, conflicts are not about if you respect me, I need to respect you, I respect you, you need to respect me, and how are we going to work this out, because they're totally opposite. Because so often, it's not a need versus a need, it's a need versus a want. And with the simple formula, as I said before, the simple formula is that if a want has to give way for a need, if there's respect. Obviously, that's not always true. And what will happen sometimes is that there's a need versus a need, and that's a problem. And in your relationship, when there's a conflict and it's a need versus another need, and they've worked it through and they do have respect, but it's something I need, it's something you need, and it's a need versus a need, that's a problem. But then respect has to really go into motion, and we just have to work towards a win-win situation. We have to find a creative compromise, a creative solution. Each one will have to give a little bit. Each one will just have to learn to compromise their need, but it's got to be mutual, and it's got to be with real respect and real alternative and creative ways of trying to accommodate both needs. And that's really for a different discussion, and maybe we'll get to it when we talk more about communication. We'll try to give some examples. But I just wanted to sort of focus on that formula, because it's a real issue. Every time we talk about respect, inevitably that question comes up: where's the two-way respect? And having said that, it is okay, and again, we're going to talk about this more when we get to communication, that when we do have respect for others, we also, everyone, one of the needs that everyone has, by the way, is to be respected. So it is okay in a relationship to communicate respectfully to the other person that you don't feel respected. Right? So that need to be respected needs to be verbalized and needs to be made very, very clear. And if you think it's a one-way thing, that you're respecting but you're not being respected, that's something that has to be dealt with. It's something that has to be brought up, and it's certainly something that has to be highlighted and dealt with.
I would ask, if someone has a genuine need and the other person's constantly giving in to the need because there is a genuine need, and they have a want, and their want is not being fulfilled because the other person has, you know, a high need. How do you kind of deal with that frustration that your want's not dealt with them?
Okay, so that's a good question. But, well, it depends first of all how severe and how significant it is. I mean, if it's a huge want, it maybe borders on a need.
If it's supporting somebody emotionally.
So well, you see, sometimes a one, if it's suppressed for too long, it becomes a need. What I mean by that, let's say you're giving in because you, let's use your example. If you're supporting someone emotionally for a very long time, right? And if you're not getting the time that you want, after a while that will become a need. In other words, if you give up too much sometimes, because everyone needs some time for themselves, everyone needs some nurturing on their own, for their own identity and own personality. So eventually that will become a problem, and you'll have to expect that back. So you'll have to expect some sacrifice back, so that you can fulfill that need, so that the want, it's okay to give up a want, but it's not okay when it becomes so bad that now you're lacking something which is an essential need. Just before we go on to today's topic, really, I just remember once I counseled a couple that were married a short while, and the relationship had really become totally dysfunctional. I referred them to professional therapists, etc., but I was very involved in the whole story. And it was very interesting to observe what was happening, because essentially, supposedly, the friction, the problem, the dysfunction came because of a conflict of needs. It had to do with where they were going to live and what he was going to do or she was going to do. Essentially, they got married kind of under false pretenses. They misunderstood each other. There wasn't good communication beforehand. He thought, she thought, whatever the case was, bottom line is, there was a real, it wasn't just about what's for dinner tonight. It was like a real issue of where to live and what to do and what path to take in, you know, in life. And it was just, the relationship completely deteriorated. And initially, they came looking for a way to solve the issue. In other words, to solve, what's the solution to the problem? And talking to them, and the same thing, same feedback I got from the therapist who was dealing with them, it became very, very obvious that actually the issue wasn't conflict of needs. The issue was that relationship never began with respect. It was a romantic relationship from the start. They fell into it. They actually had no real valuable respect for each other. And going deep into them and asking the hard questions, it actually became apparent that they really didn't respect each other. They actually had no respect for each other. He didn't think she was intelligent. She didn't think he was not. Whatever, right? So, and they try as hard as they would try, they couldn't actually find respect for each other. They essentially didn't respect each other. So I have to break the news to them that it's actually not about the path in life, the career, or the geographical location. It's much, much, much deeper. And if you really cannot respect each other, if they had deep respect for each other, the issue actually wouldn't have been such a huge issue. If they had really respected each other, there were a number of creative solutions that were possible and available for them to try. They could try one thing first, and they could agree if it doesn't work, they try something else. There were various ways of working it out. But they were useless, totally useless, on the backdrop of real disrespect for each other. And when there's real disrespect, a relationship just cannot function. It's one of the few times that, as a rabbi, I advise them to call it off. I mean, Torah gives room for that. It wasn't going to work. It just clearly wasn't going to work. Right? Because when you have conflict, if there's a spirit of giving, if there's a spirit of respect, the solutions are much, much more available. But when the respect isn't there, that's when it highlights it's such a terrible problem. So the conflict becomes bigger when there's no respect. Okay. Let's move on to the next thing, which is empower. One of the outcomes of respect is not just to respect another person, but to empower them. What does that mean? The foundation of respect, the way we talked about it in the very beginning, is that respect means respecting the person as an individual and the importance of preserving and maintaining the individuality of a human being, right? What that means is, therefore, that in a relationship, you cannot just respect another person. That's not enough. You actually have to take it to the next stage. In a relationship, you actually have to facilitate the development and the growth of the individuality of that person. In other words, you value their individuality and you value their contribution to such an extent that you actively encourage and you facilitate the expression of that individuality. One thing that cannot happen in any relationship, even a hierarchical relationship, is for one of the parties of the relationship to be passive. That's not a relationship. A relationship means where both people are expressing their individuality in the relationship, and both people are contributing, like we said last week. And part of the way that happens is for each person to encourage, to help, support, and facilitate the expression of the other person's individuality. To help them express their individuality. To make it easy for them to be an individual and to express their unique contribution in the relationship. Right. Let's take an example of the most hierarchical relationship. Right? The most extreme hierarchical relationship is the relationship between God and us. Right? It's more than a teacher and a student, more than a parent and a child. It's a, if we talk about, as we did last week, of horizontal and vertical relationships, God is the ultimate vertical relationship. We are mere mortals who have a relationship with we are finite, limited human beings that have a relationship, and it's supposed to be a relationship. We've talked about this before. The giving of the Torah was not just a communication of commandments. It was actually a marriage, we are taught. It was a relationship. But it's a relationship between little tiny people, finite mortal human beings, with an unlimited, infinite God. Right? You cannot get a more of a hierarchical relationship than that. Yet it is very clear, that the way this relationship has to work, and the way it's explained in various sources in the Talmud and the Chumash, is that this relationship has to be one where God is not interested in us being passive. He's not interested in us just being robotic, obedient human beings. His role is to provide the moral code, because that's the way it works in hierarchical relationships. A parent has to set the values for the child. A teacher has to decide what's right and wrong and what's the appropriate knowledge for the child to learn. So of course, in the relationship between us and God, how much more so, He is the one to provide the code. He's the one to provide the moral compass. He's the one to tell us what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing, what is absolute morality, what is right and what is wrong. That's His role, and we need to respect that role. But at the same time, even though we are completely, one would imagine, on the receiving end, we are meant to be active participants in that relationship. And each person brings a unique contribution to that relationship. You know, every day in the temple, the high priest, or one of the priests, one of the Kohanim, would kindle the menorah, would kindle the candelabra. The candelabra had seven branches. So we are taught that the seven branches, the flame represents the soul. Because there's a verse that says that every person's soul is like a flame, like a candle. When the priest would kindle, the menorah would work like this. The candelabra in the temple was made out of one solid piece of gold. That's the way it was made. It wasn't allowed to be made from different pieces of gold. Right? It was one solid piece of gold. And yet, that solid piece of gold was designed and formed in such a way that there were seven branches. Right? What was the purpose of the seven branches? Because we know, we've talked about it many times, that each person, we are governed by seven emotions. Right? And each person has a primary emotion that drives their personality. Because each person is different. When the Kohen, when the priest would kindle the menorah every single day, he would kindle that menorah because there are seven different types of souls. We all made of one piece of gold. We all have the one value system that we should follow. Yes, we all have a certain foundation that is generic, but nevertheless, we all have our individual way of expressing that. And God asked the Kohen to kindle the menorah because God, the symbolism of the Kohen kindling the candelabra was to elevate and inspire and instill and infuse energy into each soul. That was the idea of kindling the menorah Kabbalistically. It was the Kohen infusing energy into the soul, that each soul should have the power to serve God in his or her individual, unique way. The beginning of the Jewish nation is that we have three fathers and four mothers. Right? We all come from the same Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And then for some reason, God designed the Jewish nation in such a way that Jacob should have 12 sons, and then the 12 sons should split into 12 tribes. Why does he need the tribe? Why do we need to be 12 tribes? Why did the Jewish nation have to be designed in such a way that right from the beginning there's 12 different communities? It was going to happen anyway. But why from the beginning does already there have to be 12 groups, 12 sects, 12 shuls? Couldn't wait a little bit till we do this to ourselves. God sort of almost imposed that system on us. You know, two Jews, three opinions, you know, the two shuls on the island, the one you go to, the one you don't go to. That's God's fault. He did this right from the beginning. Now, it needs to be, that's a story of disrespect, but there needs to be, but it's part of the divine design. Because we were designed to contribute different aspects to the relationship between us and God. On Monday at the step course, we were talking about the concept of the two parts of the Torah that God gave on Mount Sinai. The written Torah and the oral Torah. And now's not the time to go into a long discussion, but the point is this. When God gave the Torah, He didn't give us a book with everything prescribed, like from beginning to end. This is what you've got to follow and that's it. He actually made it much more difficult. He actually made it in a way where He would give us the Chumash, the written Torah, and then laws of interpretation, which is the oral Torah. And the oral Torah is a struggle. It's something that we've been struggling with for 2,000, 3,000 years. Why? Because the way, and I said it's obviously a broader discussion, but just to bring out the point, the way the oral Torah works is that the interpretation process has certain specific parameters, but it's so complex that it gives rise to so many different opinions and creativity and ways to interpret things in different ways. And God says, you work it out. I'll give you the system and you work it out. Why? Why did He do that? Why couldn't He make it simple for us? Why couldn't He make it simple for us just to give us a set of guidelines and we'll follow them? Why did He give us a whole sort of complex system that's oral and have to be passed down from one generation to the next and give rooms for doubt and dispute and different opinions? Because God didn't want us to be passive. He didn't want to control us. He wanted us to serve Him as active participants in the relationship. A relationship is not a relationship when we project our identity and impose it on the other person. That's not a relationship. A relationship is the other way around. A relationship is when we are so supportive and so respectful that we empower, we facilitate the person to bring out, to nurture, to reveal, to thrive and to develop their own identity, their own individuality. But it's something we have to actively do, just like God did. We have to do that as well. We have to expect from the other person that they contribute to the relationship because they want to, because it's them in their way, not imposing us. Now, it sounds very simple, this, but it's not. Because we talk about this, but we're very quick to do the opposite in many, many different relationships. Because as soon as a person becomes passive in a relationship, the individuality is compromised. Now, this is particularly true in hierarchical relationships, where it's so easy not to do that, like for parents and children, teachers and students. Parents so often impose their identity on their children, and it doesn't work. It works for the particular child that happens to have the same personality as the mother or the father. But it certainly doesn't work for the rest of the kids. And guaranteed, not all kids are alike. Right? Anyone who's got children knows this. Right? Because each one is different. As I said, it doesn't contradict the role that we have. Yes, we have a role to provide the set of values. But we have to make each one express it in their way. And the challenge of a parent, challenge of any person in a hierarchical relationship, is to recognize the individuality of that child, to discover what it is, to nurture it, and to actually identify what it is, because it's not always easy. Sometimes a child doesn't know it themselves. But we as parents have to actually be the one to facilitate that empowerment. We have to empower children to make that choice on their own through the expression of their own unique contribution and individuality. But it's equally true in horizontal relationships. It's equally true in relationships which are equal. That we need to be a support for each other, because sometimes it's not easy to do alone. Sometimes we tend to compromise our own individuality, and we need other people to support and facilitate the expression of our own unique contribution. Which leads to the whole issue of control, and I think that's a very important place to bring it up. The issue of control is one of the most destructive things in any relationship, where one person tries to control another person. Now, to be clear, we're not talking about abuse, we're talking about control. Two different things. Abuse is an outcome of control, but I'm talking about way before we get to a point in a relationship where you can call it abusive. Sometimes people think that as long as I'm not being abusive, just controlling, it's fine. It's not fine. Because control is a compromise of someone else's individuality, of their dignity. Let's understand what control is. Generally, the word control is not a bad word. Right? The word control is a good word, as long as we're controlling ourselves. Okay. No, I mean it seriously, because every person has a need to control. We're born that way. Why? Because control is such an important thing. The problem is that some of us are too, it's too hard to control ourselves, so what do? We re-channel the control onto other people. Right? We try to control what's going on around us. We try to manage everything. And it's a very subtle thing. You know, there are certain people who have personalities that, you know, they accomplish lots of things. They're always, they, sometimes you think a person is a good leader, and they're not a good leader, they're actually a good control freak. Right? Some people, you know, you look at them, they'll take control. Taking control is not a good thing. Look, there are times where you need someone to step in and take control, right? Taking control means that no one else counts. Taking control means, you know, people confuse words. We have this wonderful sort of English word confusion issue. Some people delegate. It's not delegating, they're controlling. Right? There's a big difference between delegating and controlling, right? This is also in a work environment. Delegating means that someone has a function that's their function. It might be their job description, and you give it to them to do. Controlling means you get everyone to do what you should be doing without consulting, without asking them what their opinion is. Right? Controlling means that you are loud, bullyish in a subtle way. You impose your opinion on other people. You make it too hard for people to reject and to resist. And end up doing what you want them to do. That's not delegation, that's control. So control in essence is a good word. But control really, because, why is it a good word? Because it's an essential ingredient. God created this concept of control because in fact, as we've said so many times, that is the unique ability of a human being to control. We can control. We can make choices and control ourselves. We can control the way we respond to other people. We can control the choices that we make. We have free choice. We can make choices. The problem is, as I said, that sometimes we don't want to control. So what we do is, we control other people. Now, sometimes also, again, it's easy to confuse because sometimes we need to control to a point. Not control, we need to lead. But we miss that line. We confuse what is control and what is leadership. Again, a teacher in a classroom is a leader. Leadership is an important thing, but leadership is not control. Leadership sometimes means you have to influence. You have to have a positive influence. You have to show right from wrong. You do have to direct, but providing direction is not control. Because providing direction means you provide direction, but you empower other people to absorb that direction in the way they want to express it. There's nothing wrong in trying to influence people, by the way. Depending on what it is. If you think something is right, if you want to campaign a cause, that's a good thing. But not in a way of control. We all have our convictions. We all want to control, not control, want to convince our children of certain things. We have our convictions, we want to campaign certain causes and try to get the community around us to do certain things. We might even want to motivate our spouse to do certain things. But it's only effective, it's only considered leadership. And leadership is a tremendous thing. Control is a tremendous thing. But it's only considered leadership if we are empowering people to absorb that direction, that influence in the way that they can do it. In the way they can express it. So what's the definition of bad control? Let's have a look at that. Okay. First of all, bad control is when a person tries to control something that they cannot control. That's bad control. Right? Going back to an example we said before, you try to change someone's personality when you know you can't. That's not control. That's bad control. When you try to control a situation that you can't control. Some people get involved in things that they just They know they need to leave because it's not within their sphere of influence. Right? Another form of terrible control, and I want to bring it up here because it's a part of empowerment. It's the opposite of empowerment. Right? When a person controls another human being through guilt, or through intimidation, or through manipulation, no matter how subtle it is. And if you think about it, we tend to do this sometimes. You know, we'll drop a comment. Right? A subtle thing, a subtle hint, but it's like niggles. It's like a bit of, you make the other person feel guilty, so they want to do something. Controlling or getting someone to do something through guilt, intimidation, or manipulation is bad control. Right? Controlling means whenever you control and your control results in a compromise of someone else's dignity, that's terrible control. Controlling by compromising individual expression of someone else is bad control. I think a number of years ago, I might have told you the story of, it's recorded in Rabbi Twersky's book on spousal abuse. An amazing story of someone, a wife that was abused physically and eventually ended the relationship. And the abuse started 2 years before the divorce. She eventually divorced him. And when the rabbi, the counselor, asked them how long they'd been married, they were married 19 years. Right? That's a strange thing for someone to suddenly start abusing his spouse after 17 years of marriage. But the story goes, if you have a look at the story, it's quite in detail, but the point of the story is this, that when you ask the right questions, the abuse didn't start with physical abuse. The abuse started as soon as they were married with subtle control. Sometimes in marriages, there's a control of finance. It can be very subtle. Don't worry, I know it's hard for you. I'll control the finance. You don't have to worry about anything. I'll give you money whenever you need. And she didn't realize it. When she wanted to buy a present for someone and a friend asked, why don't you just put it on the credit card, when she suddenly realized she doesn't have a credit card. And then when she came back and asked me, she said, no, credit cards, you know, he was the financial expert. Credit cards are very bad things. Now, there might be bad things, provided they both don't have credit cards. There are marriages where people made a decision. There are couples that have made a decision. I mean, even in today's world, we sort of hard to get anything without a credit card, where people have made a decision, a joint decision, not to have a credit card. That's fine. But it's not fine for him to have a credit card and her not to have one, right? It's okay. You see, every relationship has a different context. It's okay not to give your 7-year-old a credit card, but because today there are kids running around with credit cards that are too young for credit cards, and I don't think it's a form of control to tell them that they can't have one. Right? I also don't think it's abuse to tell an 8-year-old they can't have a mobile phone, by the way. Right? There are things that are age appropriate for different people, and it depends how you tell it, depends how you bring it out, etc. Right? So we need to keep that balance. Like when I talk about empowering a child, I don't mean to turn an 8-year-old into a 35-year-old. Okay, a different discussion for another time. But there was subtle compromise of the individuality. Especially when it's a marriage, especially when it's an equal relationship. That wasn't leadership, that wasn't help. That was taking away some form of control, taking away some dignity. Subtle, chipping at it very slowly. It took 17 years till he finally hit her. And then it translated into outright abuse. And she was lucky enough to know that she has to leave the relationship. But that was a compromise of her individuality. A compromise of her ability to make a decision. To have the means which was available to buy something and not to buy something. Right? It was outright abusive, it just was subtle. It was subtle control. It was the exact extreme opposite of empowering. So therefore, the application of empowerment is in a relationship. It's not just enough to respect, but you have to empower. For example, in any relationship, you have to value someone else's opinion. But not just to value someone else's opinion when it's given. You have to seek someone else's opinion. If you have a relationship with someone else, you have to look for their opinion. It needs to be important to you what they are saying, because it's not just enough to respect their individuality when it's expressed. That's respect. When they voice an opinion. But if you really have a relationship, you will be genuinely interested in their opinion. Consultation is a form of empowerment. If you have a relationship and when you want to do something and you just do it without consulting, That's not empowering. That's a disrespect. I mean, you don't really value the individuality. Yes, you know, without a choice, if it's voiced, if it's given, what can you do? You have to take it on board. Empowering means that you look for it. You go out of your way to look for it because you know that your job, your role, your function is to not only respect the other person, but actually help them grow. Empower them. Make sure that they can express their individuality. They might not be that comfortable yet to express their opinion. You need to bring it out, even with hierarchical relationships. I think I mentioned this last week when Moses led a war against Amalek and God told him to mobilize an army, and he had a student of Joshua. He said to him, "Let us choose an army." He consulted him. "Let's do this together." Didn't have to. Yeshua would have listened to him anyway. It's part of empowerment. Whenever you make a decision, it's not about making a decision, can I get away with the decision without anyone interfering? A mindset of any decision I make, is my decision making room for the other person? What's the other person going to think of this decision? If I decide to do something, is it on the forefront of my mind the effect it's going to have on the person I have a relationship with? Because I can get away with it, maybe. This decision, maybe they won't mind or will be quiet, or whatever the case is, but that's not empowering. That's not helping them develop and nurture their own relationship, their own individuality. Now, just to end off with something very, very important, because it really completes this part of the topic. And it's called the Hillel formula. Hillel was a tremendous sage in the Talmud, a very, very famous sage. He was the leader of the school of Hillel, the one who we normally follow all halachic decisions. Hillel was very well known for his humility. He was the ultimate humble person and the ultimate person that respected other people. In fact, there's that famous story where two people had a bet if they can get Hillel to become angry. Right? I don't know if you know this story. It's a beautiful story. So the one guy said, "It's impossible to make Hillel angry. He never ever gets angry." It's a well-known fact. The other person is, "No, I'll make him angry, you see." So they made this bet and there was a... Right? So what did he do? And it was Friday afternoon and Hillel was getting ready for Shabbos and he was in the shower or whatever the equivalent was in those times. And there's a knock on the door. And Hillel quickly gets dressed and comes out and says, "Yes, my son, how can I help you?" So he said, "I've got a very, very, very important question." And he said something like, "Why do the Babylonians have flat feet?" or something. Something like ridiculous like that. So Hillel says to him, "Good question, my son." And he gives him an explanation. He says, "Oh, thank you so much." And he gets back to the shower. The guy waits till Hillel's just back into the bathtub and it's obvious that he's now in the thick of his preparation for Shabbos and he knocks on the door. He says, "Hillel, Hillel!" And he comes up and he asks him like another ridiculous question, right? And he says, and Hillel has such respect for the individual. It's hard to respect a real nudnik, right? But here, it's just hard. It's a hard thing to do. It is hard. But Hillel, for some reason, just saw the value in every person. He knew that maybe this person needs it. Maybe whatever. Okay. So he answers him and he's thinking and he goes back and this happens a third time. So after the third time, this guy gets angry. And he says to Hillel, "Is your name Hillel? Are you the famous Hillel?" So Hillel says, "Yes, me." He says, "Well, I hope there's never anyone like you again." So Hillel says to him, "My son, what's bothering you?" He says, "Because of you, I lost a bet. And I'm now 2 zuz, whatever the currency was, poorer." And to which Hillel responded, "It's better to be 2 zuz poorer than anyone to ever get angry with another person," right? Now this Hillel once made the following statement. This humble, patient, respectful Hillel once made the following statement. And he made the statement, actually there's 2 statements, but let's just focus on the one. When it was Sukkot, and there was a tremendous celebration in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple, and they were dancing all night, and they were dancing, singing songs to various words. And Hillel was leading the dancing and the singing, and he came up with the following statement, and he said, "If I am here, all is here." Like, if I'm here, everyone's here. As if they fly. If I'm not here, then there's nothing worse, right? The humble Hillel. There's another statement from Hillel also, "Im en ani limi li," if I'm not for myself, who's going to be for me, right? He has these statements that actually seem terribly, terribly self-centered. And how do they go together? And the answer is very simple. And it's an important ingredient that we must revisit when we talk about respect. You cannot respect someone else if you don't respect yourself. You cannot, same thing with love, by the way, you cannot love someone else unless you love yourself. The problem why we disrespect other people is because we have a deep disrespect for ourselves. We don't have our own individuality. We don't nurture our own identity. We're not safe with our own personality. The more we nurture who we are, the more we are safe and feel good about who we are, the more room we can make with others. And that's why, by the way, in a relationship, it's so important to respect, but it's also important to be respected. Because sometimes we have martyrs who take care of everyone else's individuality and not their own. Right? Now, I said before, relationship is about sacrifice. So we need to learn to give, we need to learn to give up. But we dare not be compromised. We dare not be humiliated, and we dare not be put down, and we dare not let our own individuality disappear. We need to do it with respect, with assertiveness, with real respect for other people. But the more secure we are with ourselves, the more we can respect other people. Disrespect comes a lot because of self-disrespect. And that's why Hillel said, if I am here, everyone is here. It's not an arrogant statement at all. What he was saying is, if I am here, if I'm okay with myself, I can make room for everyone. Hillel, the great sage, when he got nudged with this terrible nudnik on a Friday afternoon as he was about to prepare for Shabbos, he was so humbled because he was so safe with himself. He was so okay with his own identity that he didn't become any less. He didn't become any less great or any less holy or any less saintly because some meshuggah had drove him crazy on a Friday afternoon. It didn't bother him at all. He had time for him. The more a person respects themselves, the more in a real humble way we are secure with our own identity, the more we can make room for other people. And that has to do with respect, and it has to do with empowerment. The more opportunity we give, the more in touch we are with who we are, the more we can empower and respect other individuals as well. Have a great week, and next week we move on to the next letter.